episode 129 of Tea or Books. I'm Simon.
I'm Rachel.
And in today's episode, we will be doing authors who wrote too much versus authors who wrote too little. A great podcast topic suggestion from David. Thank you, David. Mm-hmm. In the second half, we will look at two very similarly titled novels. Neither of them are novels. Similarly titled nonfiction, A Room of One's Own by Virginia Woolf and A Bookshop of One's Own by Jane Chumley. But before that, and even before we get onto what we're reading, we've got some exciting news. Please drum roll in your own homes or wherever you are. But Rachel and I will be appearing at the Marlborough Literary Festival in September. Woo! Isn't it exciting? So for those who don't know, Marlborough is in Wiltshire, in the southwest, I guess, of England, south. I'm not sure how they classify it. We will be there on the 29th of September, Sunday 29th of September, talking about the British Library Women Writers series. They got in touch with me asking if I'd come and talk and if I knew anyone who I might like to interview me for it. So naturally, I thought of Rachel.
So touched.
You have to be on best behaviour, though. You can't be mean to me in front of all the people in Marlborough.
Excuse me. I think everybody listening to me, that is always the other way around.
We'll see. But yeah, we'd love you to come. If you are able to come and you're listening to the podcast, then I'm sure we'll be around for a bit before and after, and we'd love to say hello. Yeah. Do get in touch, teorbooks@gmail.com. Let us know if you're going to be there. The best way to get tickets, I think, is probably just to Google Marlborough Literary Festival and then do some searching.
Yeah,
but I'll put a link in the podcast notes on stuckinabook.com. But you can't actually. I've not worked out how to link to a specific event, so I'll just be linking to the Marlborough Literary Festival homepage anyway. So, yeah, are you excited?
I'm very excited. I'm a little bit nervous as well because I've been, I've got to sound intelligent. So, yeah,
I know. Yeah, gosh, what are we going to wear? All these questions.
Oh, so much.
And if you've ever wondered what we look like, then our photos are on the Marlborough Literary Festival webpage as well. So you can prepare for what we look like.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah. So I hope to see you there. Do let us know if you would like to say hello. And Rachel, what are you reading? How have you been?
I'm good, thank you. I'm on summer holidays now, so very exciting. And I've just been in Devon and Cornwall for a week, and which coincided wonderfully with torrential rain. So I've really a couple of nice days, but I actually got a lot of reading done because we couldn't really sit outside and drink wine, which would have been the usual plan in the sun. So I've read quite a lot, surprisingly for me. I finished reading Bodily Harm by Margaret Atwood, which is one of hers I found in the charity shop a few weeks ago that I'd never read. It's one of her early ones. And it's about a woman who is a journalist, young Canadian journalist, and she kind of has a breakup with a partner and she has breast cancer diagnosis and decides to go to a random island in the Caribbean to escape, and then when she gets there it's all full of corruption and lots of strange people doing weird things, and she finds herself caught up in a political coup situation and ends up in I won't say that to you because I've written the anyway, so that's the kind of gist of it. I enjoyed it actually. I mean, I love Margaret Atwood's writing. I didn't think it was one of the best, but I thought it was really interesting in terms of looking at, I don't know if I would say it's post-colonial, but it's certainly an interesting look at what happens to Caribbean islands once the ruling power is gone. It's a fictional Caribbean island, so it's not, I don't know what she actually based it on. But I found it interesting because I've just taught A Small Place by Jamaica Kincaid to my sixth form students, which is an essay written by Jamaica Kincaid, who grew up in Antigua but spent most of her life in America, looking at the corruption of Antigua and the legacy of it having been a slave colony, essentially. I thought it had a lot of interesting parallels with that thinking, but obviously Margaret Atwood being a white woman, not from there, had different perspective. But yeah, I found it interesting, but it wouldn't I didn't feel that it was one that I would want to reread or anything, but I did. It was a good read. If you're interested in Margaret Atwood and in her back catalogue and in her development as a writer, I think it would be well worth reading. And secondly, I read If We Were Villains by, I think it's M.L. Rio. And I read that as well for school purposes. It's supposed to be it's billed as a kind of secret history esque dark academia murder mystery situation that's people said was, you know, incredible and just as good for history, etc. I'm sure you can tell from my tone.
I can see by the tone it's maybe not lived up to that.
I did not feel the same way. It was very YA. It was very lacking in depth. I thought it was a very poor imitation, really, of the secret history set in a small liberal arts college, very selective. All they study is Shakespeare, and it's just pretty much the same situation as in the secret history, in that one of the group of students gets murdered, and one of them's in prison, and you find out at the beginning he's just out of prison, and then the rest of the novel is his story about what really happened. I mean you know how bad I am at working out what's happened in a murder. Quite early on shows you how it wasn't exactly complex, and there wasn't enough character development. I mean, it was a good lie on the sofa in the rain read. Like, it was other pages turned very easily, but it wasn't to say that it's like the secret history. Personally, if I were Donatar, I'd be rather offended. so yeah, it wasn't a keeper, but it was entertaining enough.
I think it's interesting that sort of secret history is still such a benchmark for that genre. Mm-hmm. It's quite old now, but and also, why is everything always dark academia? Why is nothing light academia? Why is nothing like...
Where's cozy academia?
Exactly. I mean, there probably is, but cozy realistic academia. I don't know. Just on your mention of Jamaica Kincaid, I'll remind people that we did do an episode where we talked about Lucy by Jamaica Kincaid. I can't remember what we compared it with now, but we did that at one point. Yeah. Oh, was it Women Talking by Miriam Toews? Oh. Maybe? I don't know. We did it at some point anyway.
Yeah.
I've also been away. I went to Leicestershire, or I think possibly just over the border into Derbyshire, in a thatched cottage that was on the estate of a national trust, which was rather lovely. I don't think there's any literary connections for that particular national trust, but it was, yeah, a lovely place to be. And I didn't take this particular book with me, actually, but I thought I'd mention it. It's one I've been reading for about 6 weeks at least. It's very long. It's called The Visitors by Mary McMinnies. And I bought it maybe 6 years ago when Barb, who blogs at Leaves and Pages, said it was one of the best books she'd ever read. She's very, very glowing about it. And I love Barb's blog. If you don't know Leaves and Pages, I recommend people check it out. She and I have quite similar taste, and she writes really well. And so, yeah, I had to have it. But then it arrived and it was 572 pages of tiny font. So I thought, I'm never going to read that. But after I did a book a day in May, I thought... I'm ready for something long. So I started that as soon as I finished all my novellas. And I'm about 300 pages through or so. I think it's published mid-century, maybe slightly later, and maybe 70s. And it's about a married couple who go to be, I guess, like ambassadors or civil servants in what is clearly a very thinly disguised Krakow. And it's very, very... densely written. I don't mean that in a negative way. It's just very, very detailed about the life of being a diplomat abroad and the various people they meet, many of whom are impoverished. I don't think they say it's in Poland, but, you know, impoverished Poles who were previously in the upper classes. Some of them are Americans and British people who were clearly in the black market, and others are just trying to get through their day job. And it's really, really enjoyable, but in quite a, you sort of just have to take it at the pace that it's given. I like a book cover every now and then, one that is just incredibly slow and immersive. And so there are some sort of quite high octane things, like they got kidnapped at one point, which felt a bit out of character for the novel. But I definitely recommend it if you are willing to slow down for it, I guess. And it's probably about 275,000-300,000 words, so it's wow. Yeah, it's a commitment, but and I probably won't read another book that long this year, but I'm enjoying being in that world, and she's a very she writes very well, so yeah, I'd recommend.
Okay, one to immerse yourself in.
Yeah. And not that many characters, which I quite like, because sometimes if you get really big books like that, there's just you're trying to keep your head around who everyone is, whereas this one just really goes into detail in a main cast of maybe sort of 6 or 7 people. Yeah. So yeah, I appreciated that.
Okay.
After our last episode, where we clearly repeated an episode we'd already done, quite a lot of people got in touch with suggestions. They could tell the desperation had set in. So thank you to Michelle, Heidi, Rebecca, I think more, but also David, who sent quite a few, one of which was this, I think, brilliant idea, which is, do you prefer authors who wrote too much or who didn't write enough books? Obviously, the ideal is authors who write exactly the right amount, and we can discuss whether or not that amount exists. But I love this as an idea. So where do you want to start, Rachel? Do you have ideas of any authors who you think wrote too much or wrote not enough?
Well, I always feel with the Bronte sisters that there isn't enough. There's far too little. It was very sad to me that there's, particularly for Emily Bronte, there's only Wuthering Heights and some poetry, and it would have been interesting to see where she went with her star. I don't like Wuthering Heights very much, but there's enough that's intriguing in there to think, I wonder what the next book would have been. And likewise with Charlotte Bronte, I mean, let's just forget that Shirley exists, but the rest of her output, again, this is somebody who's developing a style, developing a voice, developing an interest. You know, if she'd lived another 40 years, what would we have seen by the end of her lifetime? So I feel that we've been robbed a little bit there of a body of work that could have been so much richer. And I already feel that the Brontes did transform the art of novel writing, but mm-hmm. what more could they have done to develop the form and take further the art of female writing?
I was thinking about the Brontes, but I did also think while Charlotte Bronte didn't write a lot of novels, nobody reads two of them as it is. So if she'd written a lot more, would people have read them? I don't know. Would they?
Well, that's an intriguing thought. I mean, because really her reputation rests on Jane Eyre, doesn't it? So if you think about, though, I do think that Villette is a wonderful novel.
Yeah, and I think more people do read Villette, don't they? Obviously not as many as Jane Eyre, but I think, a lot of people will have read Villette.
And I do actually think Villette's better written than Jane Eyre.
Me too.
It just doesn't have as compelling a character, I think, and it's just so sad. I can't bear to go back to it because it's just every time. But her others are, I mean, Shirley is a bad book. But then she did write that at a time when she was in the depths of grief. So I think, I don't know. But I do think that's an interesting point. I mean, would she have got better or wouldn't she? And we don't know, do we? So it could be that she wrote a load of old tosh and then ended up together. She could have written herself.
Diminished her reputation, yes.
Yeah.
I was thinking, I read somewhere, and I can't remember who said it, years ago, that if P.G. Wodehouse had only written 6 books, they'd be read by everyone in the country. And I do think of him as someone who, I love P.G. Wodehouse, and I quite like that there are, I think, 91 books, but I think he wrote too much to secure classic status for individual books. People love Jeeves and Wooster as characters, and I think, people do love the Jeeves and Wooster books, but I think if he had only written a smaller number, then it would be like those titles would be as renowned as the 6 Jane Austen novels or something, whereas I think people are more likely to think, I love Jeeves and Wooster, but I don't know The Girl on the Boat or Easy Money or Uneasy Money or Quick Service or all these like individual titles that you go to a shelf and I love P.G. Wodehouse, but I always see, if I go to a shelf and it's got half a dozen Woodhouse novels in a bookshop, I probably won't have heard of half of them because he wrote so many.
Yeah, and I think when something like that is so, there's so many books, people can feel overwhelmed or intimidated and think, oh God, you know, I've got to read so many of them, or they don't know where to start or which one's the first one, and it's too complicated, and so they just don't bother.
And I'm thinking Georgette Heyer sort of like that as well, like wrote so much, and people often say they love Georgette Heyer, but I don't hear as often people say I love XYZ novel. Maybe like Grand Sophie I hear more mentioned than others, but then I was thinking someone to, you know, contrarily, like, you know, Agatha Christie wrote a million books, and obviously there are some that people talk about more than others, maybe like Death on the Nile or Murder on the Orient Express, but I think she wrote so many that, but still I'd say most of them are pretty well known. Like, you're not going to, if you're an Agatha Christie fan, you sort of know all of the titles, even if you've not read them all.
Yeah, and I think what Agatha Christie did that was clever is that she never, yes, there's a sort of series of Poirot's, there's a series of Miss Marple, you don't need to read them in any particular order, there's no a kind of in-depth referencing or forward, so you don't feel that you're missing out on something if you've picked up one that was written 20 years later than another. Whereas there are other writers of long series that do require you, I mean, you don't necessarily have to, but if you've not read the previous ones, you can feel a bit like, oh, for example, Dorothy L. Sayers, you know, all of her books are sequential, really, and they do refer back to things that happen in character development. So if you haven't read them in the right order, then you are going to feel very much out of the loop. And I did actually read one of her novels out of order. I think it was just a book that was in a holiday cottage, and I had never even heard of her. So I read it and I realised I feel like I've come in halfway through something here. And I could still read it as a standalone, but I did then want to go back and start from the beginning. But with her, she hasn't written 100 novels. She's not Agatha Christie. So it is.
Yeah. And I was also interested, I guess, along those lines, by the authors who did write a lot, but for the general public, it's as though they didn't. So I'm thinking E.F. Benson, you know, wrote dozens and dozens and dozens of novels, but is now just known as the guy who wrote Map and Lucia, basically, if people know him at all. Or E.M. Delafield wrote like 30, 40 novels, but she's known as the French Lady. And obviously, you know, there are fans who know more of those books, and there's more in print than just those ones. But broadly, and I think probably in their lifetime as well, but they became known for this very small number. So I often see people when I write about E.M. Delafield novels on my blog or on, you know, social media or something, they say, oh, I loved Our Provincial Lady, I didn't realize there was more, or, you know, which, you know, to me is always slightly mad. Like, if I love a novel, I'm on their Wikipedia page ASAP to see what else have they written, but obviously not everyone is does that. So yeah, they treaded an interesting thing where it's almost like the general consensus was like, oh, they wrote too much, let's pretend that they just wrote this handful of books and that's their legacy.
Yeah, and I think as well, when somebody's been writing over a very long period of time, there often is a kind of golden period of books that were written at a time when, you know, their writing was at its best, or when their writing was most chimed with the current fashion or what's the word I'm looking for? Lost my brain already. week of holiday. Just the current style, really, and then they fall out of fashion. If you think of someone like Barbara Pym, who wrote several novels, but the ones that she wrote after a certain period of time weren't actually published during her lifetime, and they were published 20 years later. And then when they did come out in the 1980s, I think they were published. You know, these were books that were actually written in the 50s, and they didn't feel right at the time. Felt out of time, out of sync. And I think someone like Agatha Christie in particular, you can really see a falling off of quality of her book. Because she was still writing into the 80s, I think, wasn't she?
I think so. You know, 77, I think she died. But yeah, right to the end of her life,
Writing to the end of her life in the 70s. And the 60s and 70s, I think her books really aren't that good anymore. And personally, I prefer to read the ones that were written in the 20s and 30s, and those are the most famous ones. And I think if you just read the ones she wrote later, you maybe wouldn't, you know, see her as being particularly good. And if those were the only ones we had left, then I don't think she'd have the reputation she does now. So I think that's also the risk of somebody writing books and who started their career from a very young age and keeps writing until they're much older. Their style's gonna, they either have to move with the times, or if they stay with a particular style, eventually it's going to become out of fashion, isn't it? And then you risk being judged on the ones that haven't reached the success of the earlier ones.
Yeah, like when, you know, people have said for years and years, oh, Harper Lee, what a shame she only wrote one novel. And then when Ghost Setter Watchmen came out, obviously there was all the background thing about whether or not she consented to it or was able to consent to it and all that sort of thing. But it did sort of tarnish the reputation a bit, didn't it? And not least tarnish the character a bit, because Atticus Finch, who's such a wonderful character and morally and everything else in To Kill a Mockingbird, is rather less wonderful, I believe, in Ghost Setter Watchmen.
Yes, I didn't read it out of principle, but that's what
I... Yeah, me neither, actually. So, but I'm basing that on, my brother reviewed it for my blog, I believe, so if memory serves. I was also thinking what you were saying about authors like Christie who write worse towards the end of her career. And someone I think I'd love her to have written more, but only when she was good, is Molly Panter Downs, because she wrote 6 or 7 novels, I think. And, you know, My Husband Simon is one of the ones in the British Library series. I think it's a good book, but her very earliest ones are just quite bad. And she, you know, I read Stormbird, that was dreadful. But her first one's quite fun, but she was a teenager when she wrote it. So yeah, she had certainly had not reached the quality that she reaches in her final novel, One Fine Day, which is one of the great mid-century novels.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I don't know that looking at her on paper, there's plenty of authors who wrote, you know, like Jane Austen, who wrote 6 novels. You think, yeah, that's a good number, actually. And you were brilliant in all of them. Whereas Molly Panter Downs, I think you wrote 1 brilliant novel, 1 or 2 good novels, obviously some short stories, and then some dross. And thinking, I would just wish that you'd somehow found more time in the 1940s to do more novels.
Yeah, I think it's for me, like Jane Austen got better as she aged. And I think the great sadness for me is that Sanderton is unfinished, because that's a wonderful glimpse as to where her talents would have gone. You know, that's the only novel that she started in the post-Napoleonic period, and an opportunity to write about a world that was changing quite rapidly at that point. You know, we're beginning to get closer to the Victorian era, and if she had lived to 80, she would have lived in the Victorian era. She would have seen much faster industrialization. She would have seen many more social changes that I'm sure she would have been able to write about brilliantly. And you can see her towards the end of her writing moving away from those more traditional romance novels that are focused around 2 people coming together and they're more sort of interior. And I would have loved to see her writing style develop. I mean, I think for me, her Sense and Sensibility is her weakest novel, and that's the first one,
really. And I disagree with that a lot, yes.
But
I love it.
Yes, it doesn't work. I mean, I still enjoy it very much, but it doesn't work for me in the way I see its flaws more deeply than her other ones. I would have. How wonderful would it be if we had 12?
Are there any authors who come to mind who think, yes, they wrote exactly the right number of books?
Oh, that's a good question. I think probably I would say that I think Dorothy Whipple has a perfect little...
That's a good example, yeah.
...canon of novels. And I think she stopped writing fairly soon. I think Barbara Pym has got a perfect number. You know, just the right number to read and enjoy, and to kind of, she's got a consistent style in them, so you know what you're going to get. I think that Yeah, I mean, I think to be fair, Jane Austen's little canon is a lovely little manageable collection and enough there for you to be able to reread and enjoy and go back to sort of one novel. But I'm just trying to say, I can't think of anybody who I think is, you know, yes, that's perfect. Because I think if you love somebody, you always want more, don't you?
I guess so. I was thinking of the same question. I would put like Virginia Woolf on that list. I think that's exactly the right number of books for her. Maybe Barbara Cummins, I think, is a good number. Because I think I actually disagree. I don't think that you always want more from someone you love. Because I think, for example, if Virginia Woolf had written 35 novels, I think it would dilute the sort of brilliance of her observation. And it's something, I don't know, there's something that feels a bit special about not having been prolific. I don't know if that makes sense. But so yeah, and I guess maybe the same for Barbara Cummins, because her writing is quite surreal and strange and just, it feels like selective, like it had to have only alighted occasionally on something, in the way that someone like Muriel Spark, who is also quite strange and wrote a lot of books, but I think that's a good number for her, because if it's really hard to explain, it just feels more naturally right that Muriel Spark would be prolific and Barbara Cummins wouldn't be. But I don't know if that's just because that is the case, or if it just feels more naturally right to me. Whereas there are definitely some authors who I think I love this and I just wish you'd done more and more, or authors who are like Mary Essex / I've gone blank on what her real name is, but Mary Essex, Ursula Bloom, there we go, who wrote 500 books. I'm like, if you'd written fewer, you'd have written some really good books, because I mean, Mary Essex, the ones she wrote as Mary Essex are just better than the other ones. So there are some authors who to me just seem like it's right that they wrote a lot, and some who it feels that they should only have occasionally put pen to paper.
Yeah, I think that there's something in that, in terms of also when you've only got a few books, you really treasure them and you probably spend more time with those books. Mm-hmm. And I think when you say, like, for example, what if Virginia Woolf had written 35 books? Well, I mean, nobody but scholars would have read them all. You know, it's it's too many to get to. And I think when a writer has written very few books, you can have that deep knowledge and that expertise in them that allows you to be able to make meaningful comparisons and really get into understanding the writer and the way in which that they do their craft, in a way that I think becomes quite challenging when you've got too broad a canon to work through or to draw comparisons between. And I think Muriel Spark's an interesting one. I was thinking about her because all of her novels are very, they've got a common thread in terms of the slight eeriness and characters who are off kilter in some way, but all of the stories are very different. And somebody else who's very much like that is Paul Gallico. You know, you never know what you're going to get from a Gallico novel or novella, really. Most of his are novellas. And every time you pick up something of his, it's like, you know, you can tell it's a Paul Gallico novel because of the way that he writes, but in terms of the stories are completely different. The style can sometimes be very different. And I think someone like that, he could have written 100 books and it wouldn't have mattered, really. You'd have had a different experience at the time. Whereas some writers do keep writing. People like Ian McEwan, I was just meeting a friend this afternoon and we were talking about him. I feel like all of his books are in some way, apart from his very early ones, are just the same. Every time a new book comes out, I just feel like I'm reading the same book. I'm like, why are you still telling the same story? You know, just stop now.
Yeah, I think that's, there's something in that, isn't there? That I think you feel like if they do too much that, and if they're similar, then it dilutes the impact of what they've achieved. You know, someone like Michael Cunningham, I think is absolutely wonderful, but hasn't written that many, but that's not a tiny number. But I think it's those authors who are just very observant and who really build up these complex characters. You think, oh, if you've done that many times, then it feels less valuable, maybe. I will say an author who I think would be my pick for should have written more and is still alive and hopefully will write more is our friend Mary Lawson.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're so compelling and compulsive, and you know, they're brilliantly written, but also fantastic storytelling, and the sort of book where I think she could have written 20 and they'd all be brilliant and I'd want to read them all. It's unlikely now that she'll write another 16, I guess, but hopefully
working on another one, didn't she?
She did say she was on the fifth, yeah. And that's not to diminish anything that she's achieving there. I mean, not saying, you know, they can be deleted, but there's something about the sort of compelling storytelling aspect of those that feels like I've got space for that sort of page turning book, even if they're also, you know, brilliantly written in a literary way, in a way that Virginia Woolf isn't. I love her, but she's not a page turner. So yeah, I guess maybe that's a distinction.
Yeah. Yes, I think. And for me, somebody who hasn't written enough is Donna Tartt. I love her as a writer. Every book that she's written is brilliant. There's only three. She seems to take 10 years to write a book. It's been a while now since The Goldfinch came out. So
yeah, must be not long.
Yeah, maybe we do another one. I'm excited. I mean, all of her books are so long, and I love that when, you know, you can spend a very long time immersed in the world, and I've reread The Secret History several times and taught it, and I still love it just as much, and in fact I'm probably going to reread it this summer. Now I've read The Pale Imitation of It, I want to go back to the true art of writing. And I think she is a brilliant writer, and I don't think her books are perfect, but she's a fabulous storyteller. She's a fabulous character. Like, her characterization is second to none, and it's just a treat to live in one of her worlds and to be utterly transported somewhere else, which is what I am when I read her work. Nothing else for me exists when I'm reading those books, and I just can't wait to get back into the reading. And it's very rare for me to have that compulsion to just want to not do anything else other than go back to the book.
Yeah, and I'd put Sarah Waters in the same category as long, very good, take too long between them coming out.
I mean, come on, guys, what are you doing?
Yeah, you surely don't. I mean, it's not like you're working at Sainsbury's. You've probably got enough money to just settle down and do the writing. So any final candidates for Wrote Too Much or Didn't Write Enough before we make our decision?
I think E.M. Delafield wrote too much.
Yeah, fair enough.
Of varying quality. But I can't think of... I'll tell you who I see all the time in charity shops, secondhand bookshops, and I feel like that they definitely wrote too much because no one reads them anymore. Dawnford Yates. Who even is Dawnford?
Oh, yes. It's true. I think Hayley at Desperate Reader likes Dawnford Yates. But yes, there's... so many. I do have one. I've not read it, called Adele and Co. I think Dawnford Yates is a man, but I wouldn't swear to it. And yeah, you never see just one, do you? There's always a shelf full of them.
Whole shelf. And you just think, goodness me. You know, where would you even begin?
Yeah, I think my final, I'm going to do one more of each. I think wrote quite a lot, but I wish I'd written more still, is Tove Jansson. There's just something about her worlds that I just want to go back to more than I can do. Maybe more novels, because there aren't many novels. There's lots of short stories.
Yeah.
And probably wrote too much. Arnold Bennett. Arnold Bennett clearly wanted to get a steady income because he used to churn them out, and some of them are dreck, and some of them are fun dreck, and then some of them are like The Old Wives Tale, brilliant. Or The Reisman Steps. But then, yeah, I read his book about being an author, and he was very openly just... I can get a lot of money if I do this quickly. Sort of tarnished your legacy, Arnold. Okay. Thank you so much, David. Great topic. And our decision is going to be, what are you going to go for, Rachel? Do you prefer when authors write too much or not enough?
I think not enough, because it makes it more precious.
I think I'm going to go for too much, but it is tricky. But I think the collector's instinct in me is coming into play. Like, if they've written a lot, even if it's too much, then it gives me something to hunt for in bookshops.
Yes, that's true.
But yeah, it's sort of fun. It's less easy to... because at first thought, you do think it's just going to be as many as possible, but I think it isn't that simple.
Yeah.
We do have a question for the middle, and I'm afraid I don't remember who asked it, because there's a feature now on Spotify, anyone who listens on Spotify, where you can type in a question when you listen to an episode. And I've made our default question something like, which author would you like advice about starting? But when I went back into Spotify for Podcasters, I could not find it. I did know what they wrote. So thank you to whoever you were who asked, where is the best place to start with Elizabeth Bowen?
Oh, okay. Good question. I think for me, with Elizabeth Bowen, I would probably say her best novel, and you'll probably disagree with me, is, I would say, probably The Death of the Heart. But The Heat of the Day is also very good as a starting point. But I like The Death of the Heart because I love the teenage character and that embodiment of her kind of psyche and her place in the world. But The Heat of the Day is a World War II novel, and that setting is very powerful, very compelling. And I think she captures the atmosphere of wartime London really well. So that is also a really good one, I think, to get a sense of her style and also the period. What do you think?
I mean, I haven't read either of them yet. Where did you start?
I think the first one I read was The Heat of the Day. It was just the first one, of course, yeah.
So the first one I read was The Last September, which I didn't like at the time. Maybe just because it wasn't what I was expecting. So I wouldn't say start with that. I would say from the ones I've read, to start maybe with A House in Paris, which I really loved. I think it gives you a good sense of the ability of her writing. And then I'm trying to remember the one that we read on for the podcast. She's on a train. What's that called?
Oh, To the North. That's one.
To the North. Yes.
Actually, no, you've got to read that. That's the best, isn't it?
Okay, there we go. That's the one to start with. Yeah. Teal Books' official decision, To the North, which I did love as well. You can remember the book. I can remember the title, but it's the one to go with, A Dear Anonymous Friend.
I mean, I had to lie on the floor after reading that. It was just too much.
Well, there's a recommendation.
Yeah.
And finally, the final section, we're going to talk about A Room of One's Own by Virginia Woolf, published in, I think, 1929, and then named after it, A Bookshop of One's Own by Jane Chumley, published a few months ago, I think.
Yeah.
Which would you like to introduce us to?
Can I do A Bookshop of One's Own?
Sure. Shall I start? Let's go chronologically. Okay. So A Room of One's Own was originally delivered, or a version of it was delivered as a lecture. It was then turned into a book. And the sort of central premise of it is that in order to write, a woman needs £500 a year and a room of her own. £500 a year in 1929 being a pretty good wage. It's not borderline poverty. And that's where the title comes from and the scope of it. But it's really a look at the prejudice against women in education, in literature, how men and women have been treated as authors, how men have written about women, what it means to have a literary education as a girl and a woman. It's basically a very important work of feminism that is much funnier than the words important work of feminism might make it sound. And yeah, she rambles all over the place. It's not very long, but she does cover an awful lot of topics. And that'll do as an intro.
Yeah. A Bookshop of One's Own is about the bookshop Silver Moon Books, which was on London's Charing Cross Road for a good 20 odd years. Closed fairly recently, actually, in the 2000s. I don't ever remember it, and I feel very sad that I didn't, I mean, I probably would have walked past it at some point. But this is the story of the bookshop. It was set up by Jane Chumley and her then partner at the time. And at the time, it was a very radical thing to be doing. And there was only one other women's bookshop in London at the time, which was actually on my local high street here in Islington. And they wanted to create this space where women, and also as lesbians, as Jane and her partner were, they wanted to create a space where LGBT women could also come and find books about about themselves, and but also where women could come as a space to find fiction, nonfiction, written by women, about women. And this was quite a radical concept at the time. And it was, they'd both had experience in the publishing industry, but they'd never actually run a business or a book that sold books. So the book is all about the experience of learning how to do that, but then also the challenges along the way and the enjoyments along the way. And then the change in society. I mean, they go through when they first started the shop, the internet didn't exist, and then what happens when book selling starts to change and audiences start to change, and eventually having to close the shop. So yeah, that's it.
As you say, I think so, but the Silver Moon Bookshop opened before we were born and closed whilst we were still teenagers, so sadly not so we can visit, although I'm sure there are listeners to the podcast who did visit it, and it was a shame not to be able to. Where would you like to start the conversation?
I think for me, what I wasn't expecting this book to be so informal. And I really liked that. I really loved that it was a really honest account of Jane's experiences and her willingness to acknowledge where she'd got things wrong, and also exploring things like the difficulty of running a business when they wanted to do everything right. They wanted it to be a collective. They wanted, as women, to do things differently. They wanted everybody to have a voice. And then they soon realized, actually, practically, this doesn't work. And the tensions when her and her partner Sue had put the money into the shop, but they were employing people who hadn't put money into the shop and didn't have the same stake in the shop, but they were supposed to have an equal say on decisions. So how did that work? And she's really honest about publishing the letter, because I mean, everything was letters when they first started. What would have been an angry email someone had to write leave on a desk, with employees sharing the frustrations that they had with the way that Jane was doing things or the way Sue was doing things, and seeing that, you know, you can start a shop with these great ambitions and the desire to have fairness and equality, but how individual egos and priorities and how money can often skew things. And I thought looking at the relational side of running a business for me was really interesting, alongside the practicalities of thinking about, you know, how does stock work and what did people want to buy and what they were surprised by people wanted to buy or didn't want to buy and what worked and what didn't work. And it was, I actually really enjoyed kind of living the day to day of it all and understanding, because I'm sure that many of people listening who listen to the podcast as well as me have quite an idealized view of what it must be like to run a bookshop and think, oh, what, how lovely. I'd love to have a bookshop. It must be amazing. And actually it's really stressful, and the stress of the financial obligations the whole time, and of the expense of having rent to pay on a really prestigious central London street, and of trying to carve out a market when there's so much competition, particularly, you know, as the 90s developed into the 2000s, and they're just not making money anymore because people are buying things online. And there's also women's writing. I mean, what she does acknowledge is wonderful is that they got to the point where they became obsolete because all bookshops were stocking these books now. They'd gone from a time when, you know, to be a lesbian was something dirty, and to the point where, you know, Pride was being celebrated and marched past the shop, and every bookshop had a section on LGBT books. Every bookshop had these what were once obscure women writers available, and that sort of need for a specialist space just wasn't there anymore. And I think that social history as well I found really interesting.
I agree with you about the how interesting it is to see behind the scenes of a bookshop. I think I know enough about myself that I would be terrible at running a bookshop, and you know, it would just no business sense. Although often they didn't seem to have that much business sense either. It was a real mix. And she must have kept incredibly detailed notes, because we get so much, you know, exact stock takings at different times, how much different things cost, or the different things happen in different meetings. So she's obviously got these very detailed journals to draw on. I started the book, I will say, when my heart sank, because I thought at the beginning it was just so badly written, the first section about this sort of potted biography. And it was, maybe it was because I had just been reading Virginia Woolf, but it, lots of quite amateurish things about, you know, a paragraph where every sentence was the same length or something, the sort of thing that you learn not to do quite quickly. And I don't know if I just got used to the quite informal writing or if it just got better, but thankfully I still really enjoyed the book after that. At first I thought this woman is not a writer. I don't think she naturally is a writer. I think she, you know, is many other talented things, but I don't think her gift lies necessarily in writing. And if it weren't for how interesting this narrative was, it wouldn't be worth reading a book by her, if I'm honest. But I got past that, and I very much enjoyed after that. I did find it a strange mix of quite informal writing and then footnotes for everything, which felt slightly silly to me to have, like, and every time she mentioned her journal, she'd have to footnote it. And I just didn't know why she was doing that, because it's not an academic book, but it sort of had the apparatus of an academic book. Was a bit curious.
Yeah, I mean, I felt the same. I do think you're right. She's not a natural writer, and a lot of it is quite clumsily written. But I think she views this as being the kind of record of the history of the shop, and she wanted to show where she'd got. I mean, I think she really sees this as her legacy, and wanting to put it down in writing, because this is a unique heritage of women's publishing history, really. But, you know, I don't disagree with you. I mean, initially I was like, oh dear. But I was so swept along by wanting to find out about it that I didn't put the writing to one side.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I think she doesn't hold anything back. There's these, you know, there are particular nemeses, like people on the local council or something, where she gives them their name and, you know, all the battles they had over rent increases or what they were allowed to stock in the shop, all these sorts of things. I do think it's interesting. You mentioned that Sue was her partner and both business partner and romantic partner. And they're sort of tucked away sort of halfway through the fact that Jane left her to have a relationship with someone else who worked in the shop that didn't last very long. And I think if Sue was writing this book, it would be quite a different book. Sue sadly has died, but I think that was probably a huge moment in Sue's personal and professional life, and also in Jane's. But Jane clearly doesn't want to dwell on it, just moves on. Sue is clearly very forgiving, quite happy to continue working with her, or at least does continue. I thought Sue just came across as this amazing woman who resilient and wise, and I really warmed to her.
Yes, I thought I was quite taken aback by that, because it was just sort of an aside. Oh, by the way, that wasn't a thing anymore because I had an affair. And I thought it was quite brave of her to be very open about it. But yes, I would have loved to have heard Sue's side of the story. But they were obviously very close right until Sue's sadly early death. And but I would have been interesting. I think this book would have been a very different beast if both of them had been able to be involved in the writing of it.
Yeah, yeah. And let's talk about A Room of One's Own, we mustn't forget. So I'm assuming this was not your first time of reading. When did you first read A Room of One's Own?
Oh gosh, when I was a teenager, I think.
Yes, me too.
Yeah.
There's something. There's a line in there that made me think of the link between the two, which was we think back through our mothers. Mm. This shop is sort of there, so that people can think back and indeed sideways through their mothers and sisters, and that was something that Wolf was thinking about. What do you make of the sentence "we think back through our mothers"?
I think it's kind of referring that, you know, women are, I suppose, conditioned to have that very female view of the world and to see themselves as part of a line of people who are going to procreate, really. And you look back and you think about your mother with the thought of that you're going to be a mother yourself, and that kind of that's how I've always read it. We think through this very maternal way back, and the idea of women as carers and Yeah, I mean, I've always actually struggled with A Room of One's Own because it's not what people think it is. And it's no
say more.
And it's not what I want it to be.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I find it troubling in some ways. I think it's but number one, I don't think it's very well written. I think it's very rambly. And a lot of it doesn't need to be there. And all of these fictional people that she makes up, it's like you could just write your own experience, or you could have actually interviewed some people or done something. And just making up these random hypothetical characters and a hypothetical college and all these other sorts of things, you know, just speak the truth as it is. But I think she talks, what I don't like really is the fact that she sort of spends a lot of time talking about how women haven't had opportunities and so on, and she acknowledges that. But then there's this sort of assumption that everything, I mean, I'm reading it too harshly, but it reads very much to me like she's saying, look, women are writing now, but they're all a bit crap apart from me. So, you know, it's going to take another 100 years for us to actually write anything decent. So everything that you guys do right now is just going to be contributing to a possible future in 100 years time when women might have something worth saying. And I find in all of, I mean, Virginia Woolf was not a feminist, and I find it dangerous that A Room of One's Own is given the title of being feminist, because it isn't, and I don't think Virginia Woolf would ever have categorized it as such. She's making the very valid point that women have not been given the same opportunities as men. That doesn't make it feminist.
Oh, I don't agree with you at all. Yeah. About anything you've said, really. I don't know where to start. Okay. I mean, it feels wrong for me to say that I think it's feminist when a woman is telling me it isn't. But let's move on from that awkwardness and let's keep going. I think the thing that I find compellingly feminist about it is, well, partly I think saying that women, like drawing attention to the fact that women haven't been given the same rights as men is at least base level feminist, surely, but maybe not. But I guess I love what she says about finding space in the canon for the way that she wants to express herself as a woman against, I don't know, what is traditionally be considered good because it is masculine. Obviously, feminine and masculine don't map completely onto man and woman, and she talks a lot about being a, you know, having both those things in you. But I love when she talks, and this is still, I think, so important and not acknowledged, that a novel about sport is considered important, a novel about fashion is considered not important. She says something about why is it that war is thought more literary than the feelings of women in a drawing room. That sort of thing, I think, does reflect on, I think that's a feminist statement, and I think it's a part of feminism that is yet to be achieved, in that I think reviewers still think that a novel about war is more important than a novel about the feelings of women in a drawing room.
Oh, absolutely. And I think when a man writes a book about people in a drawing room, it wins the Booker Prize.
Yes.
When
a
woman writes a book about women, people in a drawing room, it's a beach read. So, you know, we absolutely, she does make a number of valid points. I just don't think she goes far enough. And I also think that this idea that a woman needs a room of her own and £500, again, is, you know, okay, great, but the reality is most women are never going to have that. So I think it's a hugely classist piece of work. She's talking in these lectures to a group of already very privileged women who have been given the opportunity to go to university, which at the time would have only really have been upper class or upper middle class women. Mm. Who've got the money to go and the leisure time to go. And this idea that in order to write anything meaningful, you have to be locked away in a room and not have anything else to do and to have all this money. I just think it kind of furthers this idea that writing is something, or creativity is something, that has to happen outside of the world. And I don't think that's true. I think that in order to be able to write, you have to be living in the world, because otherwise, what are you going to write about? And suggesting that in order for women to be great, they basically can't get married, can't have children, can't work, I think is a nonsense, because men have always been able to get married, have children, work and write. So why can't women? Why aren't we advocating for that kind of equality? That's why I don't see it as feminist.
Yeah, I guess I would. Yeah, if someone published it now, I definitely would not think it was saying the right things. I guess I'm thinking of it in the context of when it was written and what it was railing against. That yeah, it was a stepping stone. It's not, you know, third wave feminism for sure, but it's. I think it was something that hadn't been said quite like that at that point.
Yeah. I mean, yes, I will agree with you on that. And I think what she is saying is valid in terms of, you know, the fact that she talks at the beginning, doesn't she, about how, oh, well, you know, I'm at this college and I want to go and do some research. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm not allowed in the library because I have to go as a woman. I have to be accompanied by a man. And so she does talk about all of those barriers. And I like the, you know, the Shakespeare's sister and how she ends up buried under a roundabout in Elephant and Castle because you know, she doesn't have the same opportunities. And I think that's a very powerful comparison to make, that her saying that, you know, there's no reason why women have not been able to achieve the same things as men intellectually. It's just opportunity. And she does, I think, is one of the first people to make that point and make it in a compelling way. But I do think her point is lost amongst a lot of unnecessary bump.
Yes, I want to pick up some of the things you said about that, if I may, as well, because I see what you mean about why didn't she do more research and not have these fictional characters. But that's part of what I love about it, I think, is that she's writing this as a novelist writing nonfiction, I think. So it's not someone, she's not stepping completely away from the world of being a novelist. She's using those skills to illustrate her points and often quite a sort of, I think, whimsical way. I don't think she'd like the word whimsical, but... I think she is incredibly funny. I think this is a very funny book. And I think the way that she introduces these sort of made up characters or drawing on stock characters or something means that she's sort of conveying her points in a storytelling way. Again, it seems to me, you know, if the history of polemicism is a very masculine thing, then she's finding what she considers to be a different feminine way of doing it. So she's not sort of on a soapbox giving her statistics and, you know, her list of, you know, manifesto needs. She's saying, I'm going to do this in the way that feels right to me, in the sort of sentences that feel right to the way I want to write, not to the way that I've been told by the patriarchy that I have to write.
Mm.
Very unconvinced.
I think for its time it's got a lot of interesting things to say. Do I think that it is a towering work of feminist literature? No. Do I think it could have been better written? Yes. Do I think it goes far enough? No. But I can't change who Virginia Woolf was. I mean, she was an elitist snob. And
we got that nasty review saying that the female host criticised Virginia Woolf too much. We're going to get another one. Didn't even know her name.
She was an elitist snob. And I think but she was also a brilliant, brilliant writer. And we have to sit that alongside the reality that she wasn't always kind and she wasn't always as open-minded as we might like to think. You know, people aren't perfect. And I don't expect her to be, but I think we just have to be careful that we don't make her out to be saying things or, you know, advocating for things that she actually wasn't.
I do think maybe people put more expectation on nonfiction than fiction if it's historic or if it's from the past. Like we sort of throw things, or more inclined to throw things out if they are nonfiction that isn't as progressive as we'd hoped, in the way that I don't think people would for novels, maybe.
Yeah. I think, well, because nonfiction, it's more overtly the author's voice, isn't it?
Yeah. When it comes to being written, I actually had to put this down several times because I was just like, this is just so astonishingly well written that I can't cope. So different view that I just feel like it's sort of almost miraculously well written. But you know, I'm such a Virginia Woolf fanboy. I think particularly, I think I was going back and forth between the Cholmondeley and the Woolf, and I think Woolf is such an astonishingly good prose stylist, and Cholmondeley is quite a workaday prose stylist. She's not trying to be a brilliant prose stylist, and this is not about the style for her, it's about the content. But the contrast, I think, just really hit home to me that I don't know how much nonfiction today is written as with an eye on the beauty of individual sentences as much as Wolf did. Maybe it's the limits of my nonfiction reading, but I think she was more interested in style than substance, potentially. I think there is substance there, but I think she was more interested in writing a beautiful book than she was presenting a manifesto as such. Or a memoir or anything else.
Yes. She doesn't attempt to make it clear.
No, it's not about clarity. And I think she could summarize the thing she says in 20 pages if she wanted to. Whereas Chumley is much more about like, here are the things that happened, here over time, this happened this year, this happened this year, these are the different, economic influences and marketplaces, and all these sorts of other things. And I really appreciated the way she did that, because I'd have hated to read this if it was just very airy fairy and didn't talk about the details, because that's what we want, isn't it, when we're reading that sort of book. So despite very similar titles, I think they are very different approaches to nonfiction, undoubtedly.
Yes, indeed. And I think Virginia Woolf was actually trying, I think, to distance herself and take herself out of it. Whereas Jane Chumley is very much a personal account and no holds barred, really, account of a very, very personal journey that she went through. And rather than it just being about the shop, she chooses to make it about herself and her relationships with others. Her flaws and failures as a human being, which again I thought was quite brave, really, and I think important, because if it were just about the functioning of the shop, you wouldn't have the reality of what doing something like that and coping with all of the stress and the abuse that they got as well, what toll that takes on an individual. I think it's important to see that side of things. I don't think the thing is, I guess for me, in A Rim of One's Own, it's just not passionate enough. There's not the frustration of, all of that wasted talent over so many years. It just doesn't, she's just not angry enough for me.
Interesting. Yeah, I think I see the passion being worked into the sort of the wryness and the irony and the sort of understatement, which I recognize is not a clarion cry. It's very controlled anger. Side note on A Bookshop of One's Own, which something really amused me. So it opened as a bookshop and cafe, as she talked about that. And then the cafe closed after long, and she was like, gave all these reasons she couldn't think exactly why it hadn't worked. And then we saw a photo of the menu. And I was like, maybe it's because for lunch you were just offering pâté and salad. It was the only lunch option. Maybe that was the reason, Jane.
I was really depressed. I looked at that and I was like, God, is that what people had for lunch in the 80s? Like, pâté, salad, quiche. I'm like, come on, guys.
mushroom soup. It's like, guys, where's your sandwiches? Where's your, pastries? Where's your cake? It looks, I was like, I just only wouldn't have gone in. Oh, we forgot to say, actually, the cafe, I think maybe the basement, no, just the cafe, it was a women-only space, so they had to make it a club.
Yes.
Like a sort of ladies' club to get around the law on that. That was interesting. And people thought that men weren't allowed in the bookshop part, but they were. So there was a funny story about a woman whose husband stood out resolutely in the rain, and the woman browsed for a while and eventually said, do you mind if my husband comes in because it's raining so much? It's like, oh, it is loud. We've gone over the hour, so we should wrap up. I'll do mine because it's more obvious. I think A Room of One's Own is one of the great works of the 20th century, and I think it'd be very hard to beat it in my mind. So yes, it's certainly my choice of these two. But what are you going to choose?
Well, I mean, they've both got their strengths and weaknesses. I think I will be contrary and go with A Bookshop of One's Own, because I think it's a really wonderful account of what would otherwise be a forgotten piece of women's literary history.
Fantastic. What fun. It was fun, we disagree. And do get in touch, let us know what you think about either of those. I know at least one person had read them both and had made her choice. So Sarah, do let us know. In the next episode, we're actually going to do a suggestion that Lindsay sent in a long time ago, which is Babbicombs by Susan Scarlett, the pen name of Nels Schreckfeld. and High Wages by Dorothy Whipple. When Lindsay sent that in years ago, Babbicombe's was basically impossible to get, but it was reprinted by Dean Street Press, Furrowed Middlebrow, a couple of years ago. So we can do that. And that's what we will do in the next episode.
Yeah.
So thanks for listening, everyone. And don't forget, Marlborough Literary Festival. Get your tickets.
Bye.
Bye.